Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Today is our last talk on the history of railways. What we're going to try and do is two things. One, to finish off on the modern day and some of the different trends. Last time we were talking about developments, for example, in Africa and in Brazil. We're going to try and sort of finish that off. And then in the second half, just try and recap and sort of look forward. So let's, on the first one, the point I would like to underline, which is an obvious one to any listener, but is that there are not optimum outcomes. You can't sit around and say, this is best, how do we ensure it? Instead of which, there are different policies envisaged, if you like, different strategies, who have contrasting protagonists, serve different interests, and make a degree of noise, lobbying, whatever you wish to call it, politicking, and that's part of the system. So if you take France, for example, within the rail industry, there can be, and France is a good example, strong pressure saying, why do we need all this existing capacity, particularly underused rural lines? Now, this might be counterintuitive. You might think rail industry people want as many lines as possible. Actually, no. Rail industry people, and the Beeching Report was a good example of this, often want a high investment in a more efficient network and getting shot of low-use lines. So, for example, in the case of France, you've got this frozen case scenario of sustaining past commitments, lines in rural and upland areas, such as the Massif Central, used by relatively few. They're sustained rather than constructing similarly uneconomic but new schemes in urban areas where there's greater population and public transport pressures are acute. Legacy issues include, in all sorts of countries, inadequate investment in parts of the system, maybe in the entire system. And as in America, this then sets up different expectations, not only within the country, but also in terms of foreign observers, who often assume that the job of the American system is to, as it were, replicate that of France or Germany or Italy. But actually, that isn't the job of the American system, not least because there is a very different mixture of public-private finance. You can find examples at the present day in which plans for rail expansion and increase in services are frequently advanced, sometimes in a feasible fashion, but sometimes almost as if people are drawing lines on the map to conform with local political interests who all want their high-speed line. You can see that in Spain, for example. You can see that in Japan. I recently asked two Japanese politicians why the line was being built through Kyushu. And they said, this is politics there. Clearly it's going to make a loss, but it's necessary to fulfill the political requirements there. And, the same thing is probably true in Britain. If HS2 had been going with the same amount of loss, but it had been going via Norwich up to Scunthorpe, it would probably have been ditched already. But because it is presented as part of a levelling up agenda, because it is backed by powerful mayors, particularly in Manchester and the West Midlands, the situation is different. Again, you can see exactly the same thing in the case of Israel, which is an interesting one because in Israel, the government changes frequently. So you've got this kind of stop-start policy exemplified there. So we've had politics play an integral role in support for light rail as well as for opposition to it in terms of the Israel Railways 2040 strategic plan, also the idea of a new line to Eilat, which was in theory, strategically, to provide an alternative to the Suez Canal. It was rejected in 2013, is not economically worthwhile, which I think is being polite. But the plan was revised in 2022 with the new government. And in particular, the return as Minister of Transportation of an ally of Mr. Netanyahu. So in other words, what you have in Israel is Labour, which was the previous government, which had ditched this, was more attuned to the urban constituencies attracted by urban light railways, and in particular, the plan for a major expansion of Tel Aviv's light rail system. Whereas Likud has no real interest in helping Labour constituencies, but much more interested in the idea of what was presented as a strategic one, which would have all sorts of implications in terms of possible better relations with Saudi Arabia, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's not that one is right and the other is wrong. One has to get away from that very facile idea. It's that there are different constituencies of interest. Exactly the same if you look at Australia. There were lots of plans for high-speed trains, notably from Sydney to Melbourne. Each of these has been turned down. And in 2022, most recently, there was the failure of the scheme called Fast Rail, which was announced in 2018, and which involved plans for high-speed lines from Sydney out in a variety of directions, led to much tunnelling, and would have led to what the New South Wales Greater Cities Commission promised was a truly polycentric city region. In the end, however, the New South Wales government pulled out because of the rising costs, partly to do with much tunnelling, the difficulty of securing land, this sound familiar from Britain, and instead pressed for the federal government to take over the cost, which was a shift from the position of the previous New South Wales government. And again, there are echoes here that will interest British listeners, because obviously, if we move far in the direction of devolved regions within Britain, there's going to be the same kind of horse trading between these regions developing bold plans and then expecting the national government to pick up the bill. Interestingly enough, and this might amuse you intensely, HST2 was cited as a model for fast rail, and Andrew McNaughton, the strategic advisor on HST2, was the fast rail panel chair. Not finished with that, the New South Wales government has recently announced this year, in other words, plans to quadruple the tracks at the more frequent services rather than increasing speed by means of new high-speed lines. And again, that's an interesting trade-off. And again, there isn't a perfect answer. Or if one takes Turkey, Mr. Erdogan has very much associated himself with what are super high-speed railways, and part of a planned major expansion of high-speed Turkish services. Of course, what that ignores is the impact on Turkey's already very high national debt. And I think it's fair to say that most rail protagonists tend not to think about this. And what one therefore has is this, as it were, sort of contrast. So again, looking at Turkey, there is the idea for trains going from Pakistan via Iran to Turkey. And indeed, the first ran in January 2022, which took 3,666 miles, covered in 12 days and 21 hours. And this was an aspect of the geopolitics of Asian rail lines. But the viability of that is unclear, not least because there's separatism by Kurds in Turkey and Iran and Baluchis in Iran and Pakistan across where the line is actually running. And this is more generally the case if one is looking at lines in Southwest Asia. For example, the so-called International North-South Transport Corridor, agreed in 2002 and designed to move goods by sea and rail from India via Iran and Russia to Europe. Now, that actually produced its first India to Europe train shipment in 2021. But I think it's fair to say there are all sorts of tensions, not least the tensions in the Caucasus, Azerbaijan versus Armenia, and the extent to which there is an uncertainty and insecurity about gaining profit from these lines. And if there isn't profit from them, it's unclear who is going to pay the maintenance of these systems. Now, as I mentioned last time, rail works best for links within major urban communities. And for example, not just for commuting, but also rail linkage to major airports. And in some cases, let's say Amsterdam, Copenhagen, Frankfurt, Lisbon, Porto, Paris, Stockholm, Toulouse, Zurich. You know, there are all decent links by public transport to the airport. And this continues 2023. Recently, the contract was granted for the metro extension to Bucharest Airport. The situation is less happy in the United States. Some airports are linked up to rail access, notably ones I've certainly used, Atlanta, Chicago, Newark, Philly, and Seattle. But others are not, really. I mean, LaGuardia is not particularly easy to get to. Or this has only happened after major delays, such as Dulles. And instead, what you've often got is large car parks, and those have been more important to both planners and customers than access to any rail road or railway, depending upon whether you want to use American or not. Now, where we go with this is very unclear. I think it's fair to say the cost of capital, in my view, is one of the most important factors if we're looking at the history of rail since the early 19th century. And it's, we can see it being very prominent in recent decades, and this throws light on the earlier history of rail. These changes not only affect the private financial markets, but also state provision and the interaction of the two. An interaction that's been and is crucial to new developments because, of course, governments borrow on the money markets despite their zeal to print and their argument that they are not truly debtors, but they do borrow. And the period since the long boom finished, you'll recall there was a long boom after World War II, so-called. It ran out into the sands in the early 70s. And that since then, there were major issues in funding with no consistency as a result. More and more governments have carried very heavy debt. And that was the case in the late 20th century, until one got quantitative easing. And this was interspersed with more particular crises, the oil-linked crisis in 73 and 79, widespread economic problems in the early 80s, the early 90s, and the late 2000s. And on top of that, particular financial crises in many countries, including in the 80s, much of Latin America, and in the late 90s, Russia and many Asian states, Thailand, for example. And, you know, these all put pressure on government funding and tax revenue, as did episodes of, shall we say, declined growth, or you might even call stagflation, or at least just stagnation, even if there was no inflation, as in Japan over the last 10 years, and you could argue, as in Britain today. Now, going to the more recent time, the crisis of the late 2000s was countered by a general quantitative easing that continued until the early 2020s. Accompanied by low interest rates, this ensured a low cost, not just for new projects, but also, and therefore for the consideration of debt and bond raising and bank loans, long-term guaranteed bank loans, but also for the running of existing lines. This was seen, for example, in both Europe and Japan, and in my view, that's the key way to consider recent expansion. And also the nature of current plans, that in a sense, current plans have run into the same, many of them weren't viable anyway, but it's not just the COVID pandemic, it's also the financial problems of 2022 to 23. And as a result, railway companies have cast around to try and raise money from all sorts of other ways. So, for example, in Britain, Network Rail wants to build a skyscraper to overshadow the splendid concourse of London's Liverpool Street Station. Now, that seems appalling, but if you actually look at Network Rail's figures and the contrast between its costs and its revenue, you can understand why they want to build a skyscraper. And people that, as it were, abstract the rail companies' wishes from the financial context of being foolish. Now, it may be that the present moment should be seen as a correction. As it were, there were earlier periods of overconfidence, and these have been reined in, just as we saw in 1873, 1893, 1929, and for different reasons, obviously, 1914 and 1939. If so, it's clear that the long time span of many contemporary projects, not only in construction, but also with reference to the anticipated period of repayment and thus financing, are unrealistic. Because a lot of people are planning things without assuming there is going to be a future correction. And that's not very healthy. And that presents, in my view, an important way to understand rail history. That, and I would say, it's the multiple interactions of hope and experience, expectation and reality. And let me tell you, if you write books around the basis of saying, or give talks, or take part in podcasts around the idea of, let's actually look at experience and reality instead of hope and expectation, it's not very attractive, because everybody wants, to be tickled with the idea that their hopes are realistic. Same thing with the prospect of war. The prospect of war has increased greatly from the early 2020s. This means both the possibility of a devastation of infrastructure far greater than that in either world war, hypersonic missiles, atomic weaponry, thermonuclear weaponry, i.e. H-bombs, but also many of the states I've mentioned either in last week's talk or this week's, for example, China, Japan, Israel, Britain, the US, are all going to be probably affected if there's conflict. And at the very least, it's likely to be the case that the increase in military expenditure will put pressure on infrastructural investments. It's noticeable that in Japan in April 23, trains were cancelled in response to North Korean missile tests. And long-range plans for African train links, like the ones I was talking about last time with reference to Niger, are completely unrealistic if one's looking at the politics of these countries. Thus, in my view, the story of rail is being shaped anew by international imperatives, by financial pressures, and by technological developments and issues. And this approach undercuts the progressivism and idea of inevitability of development that, in my view, is anachronistic, such a view. In particular, I would argue the high cost of creating, maintaining and running railways has helped make them more problematic in terms of individual lines and of plans for new or enhanced systems as a whole. And that's leaving aside having, shall we say, whatever phrase you wish to use, unhelpful, maybe kind in Britain, rail unions. The cost is a permanent way that's more complex than that of a road, a system that's more vulnerable than a road one, and a large and therefore generally expensive labour force. And on top of that, environmental demands, not least for clean fuel, pose a problem. Now, some people have the idea of a technological magic bullet that will restore and or ensure the profitability of rail. But that comes up against the realities, not only that there are technological, well, first of all, this may or may not happen and it will be costly to run out, but also there are similarly technological possibilities for its competitors. And that also the long-standing costs of rail systems amount to a systemic vulnerability that shows no sign of diminishing. What is interesting is that if you're looking at the world as a whole, you can see that with population growth being particularly concentrated in Africa and in India, it's fair to say that particularly in Africa, provision for this growing population is not adequate. There are also questions about the viability of the Chinese model, questions that are more striking in 2023 because the hiccups in the Chinese economy are becoming, significant. And, a global history of rail should be just as much about Africa as Europe, or say Paraguay, where the system essentially largely ceased operation over the last century, quarter century, sorry, as well as Paris. The reasons for this contrast cannot be finessed by technology or hope, instead of which, what one sees yet again is the primacy of politics and the need to understand that behind the appeal of discussing things in terms of technological magic bullets, there are the reality of major differences between states and societies in their willingness to accept debt and to concentrate on expenditure on rail as opposed to other causes. So, Graham, I think we could end on that, but I'd be very interested what kind of comments you might have.
Well, I mean, on the one hand, you paint a rather bleak picture. It's certainly in the immediate future for rail, particularly large and expensive railway projects, that there's the political uncertainty, there is the economic costs, and in the case of Chinese finance, that's a combination of the two there. We've had a long period in the first 20 years of this century of low interest rates and cheap credit. We're now moving into a more expensive period, which would certainly lead one to think that these more expensive projects don't really have a future. But then you have the parallel argument that to meet net zero and other challenges from climate change, the railways are the option to invest in to stop people using the car or over longer distances using flights. How do you see these two conflicting push and pulls playing out?
Well, I mean, I think to a certain extent that is a very European approach, if you don't mind me saying. I don't think that, and it's also an approach very much focused on passengers rather than freight. And I'm not sure that that is the most important or consequential use of rail. So I would actually go back to say, well, you've got to look at the context. It's not much point talking about the choice being between rail, car, and air, as you suggested, if you're looking at, say, Nigeria, which is the most populous and wealthiest in some respects, with its large oil wealth, of the sub-Saharan countries, because its rail system is pretty appalling, is affected by political gangsterism. It's quite common for trains to be attacked by politically linked gangs. And the standard way of going around Nigeria is, of course, by road. You could double the rail infrastructure in Nigeria and quadruple the money spent on the existing network, but it wouldn't meet the demands of the rapidly rising population or the freight needs of it. So I'm not quite sure where we're going on that. Obviously, for people like you and me, Graham, it's very convenient and comfortable to have trains, and it's a way to deal with the crowdedness of parts of Britain, and that's great, and we like that. But whether that is a viable use of state money, much of which is in effect, as it were, being siphoned off for highly inflationary wage demands for the unions, is another matter entirely.
Although without that state funding, these projects are not going to be viable on any reasonable timescale.
No, then, but are they viable at all? I mean, you might say it would be rather nice if instead of building new lines in Britain, we could get some of our existing ones to work better. And maintain them better, but I can't quite see how we're going to do it with the situation where, I mean, what is it? Yesterday, 2 days ago, we were told there were going to be fresh strikes in 2 weeks' time. And how long is this going to go on for? Year after year after year? I mean, as far as I can remember, there have been train strikes for at least the last 4 years. if you look at a country that doesn't have the same degree of labour instability, let's say Germany, there are still questions. I mean, leaving aside the fact, as I've already indicated, that the German punctuality is well below what the Germans would like. Leaving that aside, there's the question of the viability of many of the IC lines that have been built. And obviously, they fulfill political purposes. But, you know, if you've got competition, you know, what do you want to compete with? If you've got competition with, let us say, social welfare payments, health payments, defence, I mean, you know, it doesn't look so good, does it? I mean, Germany's had a free ride for a number of years behind the American arms umbrella, and also because the Russians have essentially been, you know, as in Georgia and Crimea, essentially have been having very contained violence. Now the Russians have got more exuberant in their use of force. One is entitled to ask, if one's a European policymaker, if you had the choice, wouldn't you rather Germany did something about its defence commitments to NATO rather than, you know, running its trains, more trains? I don't know. You may have a different view. I mean, it may be that you want a gold-plated service from Ely to London.
That would be personally very helpful, but so long as someone else is paying for it. There is also, though, the question, isn't there, of capacity? And you touched on that a moment ago. Indeed, it's become one of the lines of defense for those still making the case for HS2 in Britain, that it's no longer about getting to Birmingham 20 minutes more quickly, since it transpires you wouldn't get there much more quickly anyway, given that you can't get into central London. It's about simply the existing network is at capacity, so there needs to be new lines to relieve capacity, because, you know, contrary to this gloomy prognosis, and in fact, people are using the railways more, despite the best efforts of railways to make the and unions to make the experience unpalatable, and therefore it's really attention should be more on improving the existing infrastructure rather than on new projects.
Well, you've just moved in several different directions there. Mm. I personally would rather improve the existing infrastructure rather than new projects. HS2 has been pushed, though, as a new project. It's not an attempt to run a new service on existing lines, and it requires very expensive construction. So I'm not quite sure that we're not talking at some cross purposes. But if you're saying a case can be made for the line, of course a case can be made for it. A case can always be made for expenditure. And often the cases might seem a very good one. That's not the point. The question is, if you've got a certain amount of money to spend or loan capacity to deploy, and as you will know, the British state is not exactly short of debt, what is absolutely crucial? Now, you could make if you wanted to make a case for train expenditure and to say, I, Graham Stewart, put my name on the line, and I believe one should be cutting back expenditure so that people in the last 6 months of what is likely to be their life don't require medical care, because obviously they should be just chucked in hospices. Say so. If that's your view, if that's where you want to get the money from, say so. But I'm not impressed by people who produce arguments for expenditure and don't then follow through on where they want expenditure cut. It seems silly to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that is exactly the problem that we have. I wondered, again, sorry to be parochial, to be asking questions about the British experience, but I think there are some interesting aspects of it, not least the rail privatisation and then the collapse of the effective collapse of Railtrack and the state taking that over. And now the creation of Great British Railways, although exactly what composition that involves, it remains extremely unclear. Where do you feel it went wrong for the privatisation movement in railways in Britain?
Ooh, that's a very interesting question. I think I would say that the problem with privatisation may well have been that the dismantling of British Rail, as opposed to just privatising it as one entity, did not produce the advantages that had been anticipated, but led to a loss of necessary expertise in operational matters. That, I think, would be what I would say, that in that the idea, which I'm told came from Mr. Major, but this may be wrong, I haven't seen any relevant documents, but that's what I'm told, to have competing companies seems to have been attractive to him, even though, of course, the reality of the Big Four in the interwar years is they didn't really compete in many senses. I mean, you know, the Great Western Network was running Great Western trains in this part of the world. You weren't finding an LNER alternative to run from Torquay to London. So I'm not sure that they did it in the wisest of fashions, but the idea itself of privatisation was not a bad idea as a way to raise liquidity at a time of pressure on state finances. So that itself was not inherently a bad idea, but I'm not sure it was executed terribly well. And of course, in recent years, it's been hit by the volatility of Britain over the British rail systems, over labour relations, over usage, to do obviously with the impact of COVID. Those have all caused problems.
Well, we're coming to the end of this series on the railways. I wonder if I can just ask you to draw together a few of the threads of the history of the railways over the last 200, slightly over 200 years, mentioning, you know, how we've gone from a system which was private, backed by private enterprise, and has now across most of the world become dependent in different ways on the state, and how the pace of innovation has slowed. Trains now are technically better than they were 30, 40 years ago, but the rate of innovation is perhaps not as strong in the railways as it has been in some other sectors.
Yes, I think that's very true. I think that there is still, as I've said, a lot to offer in terms of maintaining existing infrastructure, maintaining the capacity to develop if there are significant new innovations. There are particular values, as I've already mentioned, commuting in major cities and also bulk movement of freight. I'm not so clear, and I suppose also in some countries, in some contexts, movement between the major cities where there are existing lines already. I'm not so clear that it is worth it if you don't already have an existing line, given the amount of money that has to be invested. Now, I'm very happy to be proven wrong. It gives me no pleasure to say that I think that many of the hopes are illusory of many of the projects that are envisaged. And, you know, I take great delight in being on a good train. I was in Japan in May. It's delightful to be on the Japanese train system and its punctuality and its ease of moving people around. Of course, many of these trains, high-speed trains, are losing money. And you have to say to yourself, what is a sensible investment? And I don't know. That is a matter of politics. What is wrong is to, you know, is to foreclose the debate by saying there is a clear answer what is right, and that answer is what reflects the in self-interest, prejudices and assumptions of those making that case. And I just don't find that helpful. And I think that, you know, the public is owed more than that. It's not just a question of producer lobbies, it's consumer lobbies as well. And they're not tremendously helpful. And we're seeing in Britain that public policy, you know, a lot of people criticise this government, and maybe with reason, and I suspect in 5 years' time they'll be criticising the next government, which is likely to be a Labour one, and maybe again with reason. But the point I would make is that actually governments have to cope with often unviable, uncosted, and selfish interested demands from lobby groups of consumers and producers, and they, as it were, drown out voices saying, well, is this a sensible use of money, and is it sensible to close down other options we could otherwise spend the money on? And of course, this happens with the rail system. I mean, let's face it, the cost of fighting COVID is, I am told, what led to the end of the Eastern Prong plan for HS2. There are trade-offs. And whether these trade-offs are attractive or not, people need to be aware of them. And to pretend you can just simply say, I would like this to happen, you know, be quiet. I think there's a good, I could make you a very good case to restore the line between Exeter and Plymouth via Okehampton, which is costed at less than £1 billion. Now, I could make a very good case, and it would be quite nice for me. And at lunch today, people were talking about whether one could restore the line from Exmouth round to Sidmouth. What a surprise. Three of them lived either in or close to Sidmouth. And again, I could make a good case for those, but that's not the point. There are other uses of public funds. And even in the case of public transport, you have to ask yourself whether it wouldn't be better and more flexible to fund buses more. I don't know. These are matters for debate. What we shouldn't be doing is saying there is one answer, and what a surprise, it's my answer.
Well, that's a punchy note to end on. Professor Jeremy Black, very much enjoyed this series on the history of the railways all over the world over the decades, and it's been a pleasure to discuss it with you. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. You may, listeners may be amazed to hear that I hope to have a book coming out on railway history. They may be amazed to hear that, but there we go. Whether they read it or not doesn't matter. What I hope people have at least got the idea is that we ought to debate these issues rather than assuming there is only one answer.
Indeed, sir. Thank you again.
Thank you.